This lecture is entitled Backstrong and Beltless and was presented by Paul Check at the Canadian Association of Fitness Professionals Annual Convention in Toronto, August 2002.
Whoever was the architect of the human body was superior to whoever created the belt. Although I will also show you, in all fairness, that there is some application for a weightlifting belt and or a lumbar corset. So I like to be fair whenever I can be fair to a lot of these topics and issues, because you have to wonder, how did belt use get started? So I did a little investigation into the history of the use of weight belts and medical corsets. And in my library, I have quite a comprehensive collection of rare medical books. And I have weightlifting magazines and journals and books going all the way back into the 1800s. So what I did was spend some time investigating it. And I found some pretty logical reasons for belt use. Okay. All the way back in the late 1800s, belt-type corsets were used for the treatment of scoliosis. So they would make these special belts that help pull people's bodies into alignment. Okay? So right off the bat, we had the beginnings of belt-type structures being used for the treatment of a spinal dysfunction about 100 years ago. Okay, now lifters experiencing low back pain, and I can find historical record of lifters discussing their low back pain or weightlifting magazines all the way back into, you know, the 1920s talking about such and such a lifter having low back pain, or it was fairly common knowledge. Like if a guy hurt his back, they would talk about it and write about it. And I could find these things going all the way back to the strong or early strongman days, the days of Eugene Sandow and other lifters in around 1900. It's very likely because in the medical books of that era, there was a significant use of belts and corsets by medical doctors that were treating orthopedic disorders. So it's very, very likely that lifters with back pain were going to doctors and being told to wear belts to help them get over their back pain. Okay? Fairly logical. Now, many of these lifters probably found that their back pain was improved wearing a belt for reasons that we'll discuss later on. I'll show you, you know, how the anatomy of the body works and why a belt can actually help some people. The problem is that they didn't know when to stop using the belt. And it's a natural thing to do. So it's logical then if you had were a lifter and you had low back pain. If you were a lifter, you had low back pain, you put a corset on, it helped you. Can you see the logic that it might, you might say, well, geez, I'm going to just keep wearing that sucker. Okay. So I think a lot of them probably got into wearing belts for that reason. Okay. So how and why does a belt reduce pain and improve performance? In order to actually educate you on how belts can reduce pain and improve performance, we have to take a little tour through the anatomy of the human body as it relates to spine stabilization. So we're going to look at the inner unit stabilization, outer unit stabilization, and we're going to look at pain and its effects on the stabilizer system. First thing I'd like to do is a brief demonstration. Who in here has got a pretty good bench press arm? Do any of you wear belts that bench press? Raise your hand if you use a belt and you bench press. No. It's probably not likely you'd tell me the truth right now anyhow. Okay. All right, who would like to do a demo? Because I can do this demo with any human being and show you. I just need anybody that wants to be a demo to come up here. Okay. I don't have much room on stage, so I'm going to have to do this over here. Tell you can move that chair just a little bit. Well, you can put it back in 2 minutes. Okay. Okay, who wants to be the demonstrator? You can do it.
right on. As I can be good, you can.
You'll make a good demo.
That's a big demo. Okay, so here's what we're going to do. Just have you lean up against that wall. Now, you know how you're putting on a bench press and you're getting ready to do the bench press? Just pretend this is the bench. Okay, and just get stable like you're laying this. Put your feet away from the wall because I'm going to push you because you know this. Okay?
I hope that good one also.
No, I tried it. If it does, I'll catch him if it does. Okay? And just hold your hand up like you're going to hold a bar. You know who Gilgamesh is? That symbol comes from SRL. All right, hold that arm right there. Now, what we're going to do is test how strong his shoulder is. In other words, I want to see how much force he can take without the joint moving. So I'm going to slowly apply pressure to his arm, and he'll get a sense for how much pressure. Now, I'm going to ask you to kind of guesstimate how much pressure I'm putting on you. It doesn't matter if you're right, though. Okay. Yeah, I just want you to, if you lift it enough weights, you'll get a sense of it, okay? So just, I'm going to put yourself where you think you're the strongest position-wise. Yeah. Okay? Remember this me? So I just want you to not let me move that arm, all right? Yeah, he's strong. Okay. I can't move his arm. I mean, I probably could if I wanted to give myself a hernia. And I might flatulate while I do it. I don't think that's a good way to talk to my speaker lady. So, I don't know. How much did it feel like I put on you there?
I don't know.
A lot.
Yeah.
I mean, I was pushing, I literally was even using my calves. I'd say we were well into the 180-pound. I weigh 185 pounds, so I put every bit of it plus on him. Let's just say he's strong, okay? So now come on over here for the rest of the show. I want you to stand right here. Okay. Now I want you to choose any stance that you want. What sport do you play? You look like a shot putter or a lineman in football.
Dude.
Huh?
Football.
Yeah, okay, good. Hand up again. Now, remember, I'm going to push on you again, so I want you to get ready for this. You ready?
Okay.
Okay. Okay, so now we're going to watch and see what it takes for me to get that shoulder moved. Ready? Don't you fight me now. So he's pretty strong, okay. But hold on, I'm going to push on it, okay? Okay, so now I can get a little bit of giving it, not a lot. I mean, if I really wanted to force it, you could probably feel like I could make it go.
Yeah.
But it's not as strong as it was over there, is it? But he's pretty damn strong. I've tested a lot of people like this. I've tested a lot of professional athletes, and he is stronger than most of these guys. Well, you shouldn't be here. You should be out there kicking some butt on the field somewhere. Now, you guys all know that in sports and in most work-related environments, we don't get an opportunity to set up beautifully like that, do we? And hold real still and say, okay, here it comes, right? Yes? Oh, that thing. Have it all sorts of screw up this morning. But I'm actually enjoying it. Can you hear me now? Radio. Okay, so you all know that in sports, if you're laying on your back, you're in big trouble, okay? Unless you're a mud wrestler. And we don't have a good opportunity to just set up and hold ourselves perfectly still. But would you agree with me that in most sports, you apply power or force predominantly off of one leg? Okay. You're either jumping predominantly off of one leg, landing on one leg. If you watch a boxer throw a punch, it's weight transfer. Throwing an object, there's weight transfer. So really, your ability to apply force in a working or sporting environment is predominantly off of one leg, which is why I try to develop my athletes so that they can train predominantly off of one leg, because you'll see that what you can squat, you take a lot of people squat, divide it in half, and they can't even come close to doing that on one leg. You ever notice that? Any of you ever tried that? Okay. Or a deadlift. Okay. I can tell you, I've tried this a lot of times, and I train that way myself. It's very rare someone can do 50% of what they can do with two arms or two legs on one leg. Yet in sport, we have to do that all the time. When you come out of the blocks and sprinting, you're applying maximum power with every leg, one leg at a time. So what I want you to do now is stand on that leg, okay, and do the same thing. Put your hand up and resist me. Put your arm forward so you're strong. There you go. Hold. Oh, you hear that $40 chiropractic adjustment there, right? Okay. Okay. Hold. Okay, look at that. What happened? See, now I know how to beat this guy. All I got to do is wait till he's on one leg, and I'm going to put a whooping on him. Okay? Because when he's here, he's fine. But once he starts moving, I guarantee he's in trouble. Okay? Why do you think that is? Why was this guy so strong on the door and so strong when he was perfectly planted, but now when he goes on one leg, he's in trouble?
Unstable.
He's unstable, and he's not using his core properly, okay? Now, what do you think the difference is in force between that door and standing on one leg?
A lot more on the door.
A lot. You mean like a shitload?
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, stand on that leg again. That's a technical term. I'm allowed to use that in Canada because you guys drink beer. Okay. Hold. Look at that. That's two fingers, and I'm not even working one finger. Look at that. One finger. Okay. Do you want me to fix you?
Sure.
Okay, good. Okay, so what I want you to do, stand on one leg, use me as a support for a second. Okay, now follow my directions. Take a deep diaphragmatic breath into my hand. Fill my hand with your belly. Good. Hold the breath. Draw the belly button in and lift your testicles up. Okay? You know what I mean by that, right? Lift them up. Good. Hold that. You feel that?
Yeah.
Feel how you just made yourself a corset there?
Yeah.
How you tighten this around the midsection. Okay, relax. Take a deep, full breath. Fill the belly. Hold the breath. Draw the belly button in. Lift the testicles up, and you can even tighten the rectum. Hold the hand up and fight me. What happened there, bud? Look at that. Okay? He doubled or tripled his strength right there. I mean, I literally could have pushed on him hard. You want to try it again? Big breath. Fill the belly. Belly button in. Testicles up. Ready? Hold. Look at this. What do you think of that?
Better.
He's one of these guys that like goes to the best movie in his life. What do you think of it? It's pretty good. Hey, let me tell you something. If Madonna ever takes you out on a date and she asks you how it was, get excited. Okay, thanks, bud. So now I'll show you the anatomy of what. What was your name?
Mark,
thank you very much. That was really good. And I'll send you your check later. I'll show you the anatomy of how and why that worked. Now, Mark's abdominal wall, by the way, is behaving exactly how belt users' abdominal walls behave. And this is why they wear belts. Okay? This is why when they wear belts, they get stronger in the gym, but without their belts, they get a lot weaker. Okay, I'm going to explain the anatomy so you can clearly understand what was going on in his body. If you look at the inner unit is comprised of the diaphragm on top, the deep spinal stabilizers, the multifidus along the spine, the pelvic floor, and the transverse abdominis indicated by these dotted lines. The internal oblique is actually also part of the inner unit technically, okay? So with the transverse abdominis, you can include the internal oblique because it has origin from the thoracolumbar fascia. If you look at my artist's drawings here, I have a very good artist, as you can see. He's been working for me for years, and these actually start out as sketches by me that don't look very nice, and they end up looking like that. That's what you get for lots of thousands of dollars a year. But anyhow, if you look at the spinous process here and the transverse process here. You see this white area right here? Can everybody see that? What is that? See it right there? What's that called? Thoracolumbar fascia. Okay.
So what you see is here is the transverse abdominis here, and there's the fascia of the transverse abdominis. This is called the lateral raphe, and the lateral raphe is the emergence of the muscle into the connective tissue, and the connective tissue attaches to the transverse processes and spinous processes. And when I asked Mark to draw his belly button in, his internal organs created resistance. And when the belly button moves in, as you see here, it creates what is classically called hoop tension. If you grab a tube of toothpaste in the middle and you squeeze it, if you squeeze hard enough, something's going to blow out one end or the other, right? Okay, that's because you created hoop tension. If you grab your water bottle and squeeze it, the water will rise up, won't it? If the lid's off, it'll go right out the top. Well, when the transverse abdominis fires, it drives the internal organs up into the diaphragm and down into the pelvic floor. And anytime you're load bearing or walking, as soon as this system turns on, it tightens the anal sphincter so nothing leaks out the bottom, and the diaphragm contracts. How many of you have noticed that anytime you go to lift something heavy, your breathing stops? That's because as soon as you go to lift something heavy, your brain pre-programs itself and it says, boy, that's heavy. So it says, I need more stabilization than respiration to protect the central nervous system right now. So as soon as you feel the breathing stop, what's happening is the diaphragm is tightening down in anticipation. And then as the mechanoreceptors of the spine feel more and more compression, they increase the activation of these muscles to maintain the stiffness and stability of the spine. Okay? So all I did with Mark is I had him take a deep breath, which does what to his diaphragm? Drops it down, which pushes the organs down that way toward the pelvic floor. And then I said, Mark, lift your testicles because the pelvic floor is neurologically wired to all the inner unit muscles. So anytime a man lifts his testicles or if a woman does a Kegel or tightens her pubococcygeus muscle, it also reflexively tightens the transverse abdominis, the diaphragm, and the multifidus and the remaining pelvic floor muscles because they're all in the same neurological reflex loop. So I had him breathe in, draw his belly button in, lift his testicles, and sometimes you can use what's called in martial arts an anal lock, okay? What they teach you to do in martial arts, if you're going to really hit someone or you're going to try to stabilize yourself, you tighten your rectum. And tightening the rectum with the abdominals creates pelvic stability and trunk stability, so you have stable legs and stable arms, which makes you very rigid, okay? So by doing that, I was able to tie Mark's hand up here to his foot down here. You understand that? When I had him stand on one leg the first time and I pushed on his hand, the force that I applied here could not be stabilized by this leg because the abdominal wall was unstable. And when you use the rectus abdominis or the external obliques in absence of these segmental stabilizers, the spine is loose because the rectus abdominis runs from T5 all the way to the pubic symphysis. So it's crossing, well, T5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, and 5 is 17 joints. Well, when you got one muscle crossing 17 unstable joints, it doesn't help much to stabilize at the segmental level, does it? Does it?
No.
Be alive. Help me out here. Okay? No, it doesn't, but it actually does something else. Even though you can't stabilize, remember, around each of those joints are joint capsules, ligaments, and mechanoreceptors, which are very, very sensitive to compression, torsion, and shear. So as soon as I started pushing, I remember when I first pushed on, you hear the popping in your spine? Did you hear it? Yeah. Did you guys hear it up here?
Yeah.
A whole bunch of his vertebrae rotated because the segmental stabilizers were not on. You see, when the transverse abdominis tightens, it creates tension that stabilizes each vertebra three-dimensionally, so it can't move. Okay. The reason you heard that popping is I put a torque on his body. He's standing on his left leg. I'm pushing on his right leg. That creates a lever arm against his spine. He couldn't stabilize his spine. So you actually heard his vertebra subluxing right there. The popping sound is the facet joints gapping because those articular surfaces are matched surfaces. So it's like a coffee cup sitting on a saucer. And you know when a little fluid leaks, you got to pull it off and it goes like that. What you heard is I forced the vertebra to rotate so the joint surfaces came apart and you heard the negative pressure in the joint rush into the space when the joint surfaces came apart, just like the coffee cup coming off the saucer, okay? So what that tells you is that his segmental stabilizers were not working at all, and that causes a triggering reaction of the mechanoreceptors around the joint, And if you have activation of the multifidus muscles in absence of the transverse abdominis, it actually can encourage more forward shear, because in order for the multifidus muscles to work to stabilize, they can only resist forward shearing and flexion against, they have to work against their component transverse abdominis to create stability on the other side of the joint. Otherwise, you only have resistance to movement on one side of a joint. If you create a force on one side of a mobile joint, what happens to the joint? It moves, it shears. You have to have co-contraction. So this thing's set up so that this transverse abdominis, when it causes hook tension, stabilizes through the thoracolumbar fascia, because all the internal organs create pressure and stability inside this fascial envelope in the front. And then through this three-dimensional loop system right here, it strings that thing tight. Have any of you ever seen a Mexican finger trap? Well, you probably wouldn't be in this far from Mexico. Well, a Mexican finger trap is a little thing made of like baskets, like the, you know, basket hats. And it's shaped like a condom, except you stick your finger in it and it's got two open ends. Once you put your finger in, you can't get it out. And it's kind of a trick you do to people that don't know what a Mexican finger trap is. Like, hey, put your finger in this thing. And they put in, and they, when they pull, the more they pull, the tighter it gets, because it acts exactly like that system right there. Except because of the way it's woven, when you pull this way, it constricts. Okay, so this is very much like a Mexican finger trap right here, but it has to be turned on. And when you wear a belt, you're not likely to turn it on, because when you wear a belt, which direction is your natural inclination to press your belly button? Outward, which does what to this hoop tension? Obliterates it, shuts it off. Okay, and even if you turn your rectus abdominis on, the rectus abdominis being strung from the manubrium all the way to the pelvis, when the rectus abdominis turns on, it doesn't create hoop tension. It actually flexes the spine and makes your abdominal wall short and pulls you into flexion like that, but it can't stabilize the vertebra, so it doesn't help you. It might help you if you're going to get punched in the stomach, but it's not going to help you with load, okay? The rectus abdominis helps with the load, but it only helps in concert with the inner unit, because this is the stiffening system. That's the stabilizer system that works in the background of the big muscles. If this thing's not there, you're in trouble. To give you an analogy, this is kind of like the tie rods and the ball joints on a car. And the rectus abdominis is like the engine on a car. Well, if your engine works really well, but your tie rods are falling off, that's dangerous, because there's nothing to stabilize the front end of the car. Does that make sense to? I know some of you ladies probably are going, what the hell is a tie rod and a ball joint? But that's okay. It's okay, because I'll tell it to you lots of other ways. Now, here you can see that the thoracolumbar fascia has two lamina in the posterior layer. The yellow represents fibers running up to the L2 and L3 vertebra, and the blue layer represents fibers of the posterior layer of layer of thoracolumbar fascia. You know what lamina are? Does everyone know what lamina are? You know what a piece of plywood looks like, how it has layers? Those are called lamina, except those are glued together. These aren't. So here you have your superficial lamina, and there you have, deep lamina, superficial lamina, and they're all part of one layer. So you've got two separate layers that are called the posterior layer. So when your transverse abdominis here and your internal oblique here pull on the lateral raphe because you drew your belly button in, it causes tension on these two slips of connective tissue going that way and these two going that way, and they attach to the spinous processes. So when this happens from both sides, which is called the thoracolumbar fascia gain mechanism, what direction will that pull the spine in, flexion or extension? The other flexion. Extension. Okay, because your spinous processes are behind your spine, aren't they? Okay, so when your transverse abdominis goes in and tightens and those things pull laterally, it brings the L2 and 3 spinous processes toward the L5 and L4 spinous processes, which is this. Okay, so what you actually have here is a system of deep abdominal stabilizing that creates extension of the spine to counterbalance the flexion created by some of the bigger muscles, okay? It's a buffering system so that when you bend forward as you pass from muscular to ligamentous support, this system has to be active to make it a smooth transition. How many of you have heard of someone that said they bent over to pick something up and heard a pop in their back? Okay? That's because when the transverse abdominis doesn't work, like Mark's wasn't working, the transfer from muscular to ligamentous support is very abrupt. It would be like if I filled a volleyball up and threw it at you, but you didn't know I'd filled it with water, what would happen if I threw it towards your head and you went to catch it?
Fall backwards.
It would probably hit you right in the nose and you wouldn't like me at all, okay? Because when you look at a volleyball, your brain's programmed and it says volleyball, about a half a pound, right? But if I filled it with water and it weighs 8 pounds, you're going to have set your gamma nervous system to accept a 1 pound load coming at you, okay? So what happens here is when you're, when this thoracolumbar fascia gain system doesn't work, it creates the same effect. As you bend forward, it's such an abrupt transfer from muscles to ligaments. It traumatizes the ligamentous system with every bend, especially if you're doing things like racquetball where you're swinging a racket really hard, or tennis or martial arts where you're moving really fast in and out of flexion and extension. Can you see? And your trunk weighs 60% of your body weight. So can you imagine all the repeated shock that would be on that spine if that system was not able to buffer that? This is, in a sense, a lot like the suspension in your car. Imagine if you had no shocks in your car. Or how many of you have ever heard of a Harley hardtail, Harley Davidson with no suspension? You ride down the road on one of those things, it rattles your teeth. Well, this system acts like your shock absorber. And if it's not there, you wear ligaments out, you wear discs out, you wear spines out. And it's all dependent on the function of the inner unit. It works as a system. Here we have what's called thoracolumbar fascia gain. And this is a little cartoon I had my artist do to show you. Because this fascial envelope, I'll go back a slide. This thoracolumbar fascia is very thick and tough. Fascia has a tensile loading force of about 2,000 pounds per square inch. So it's very strong stuff. This is like the world's toughest saran wrap right here. Okay. Now you can see the multifidus muscles are encased in that fascia. Can you see that right there? Now, when a muscle contracts, what does it do? Flex your biceps and look at it. Look, see what it does. It expands, doesn't it? Well, if you try to expand a muscle inside of a non-stretchable tube, what's it going to do? It's going to create pressure, and that pressure causes extension in the spine. It's just like if you put a bicycle inner tube along the spine, you glued it to the spine, and then you had this little guy under the table start pumping up the inner tube. As the air pressure increased, it would cause an erectile effect on the spine. Can you see that? So Grakovetsky from Montreal, Canada, actually figured out that this created a significant contribution to the extension of the spine. As the muscles contracted inside this envelope, it caused an extension force. Okay. So it's one of the stabilizing mechanisms of the spine. But it's very, very much dependent on this mechanism right here. Because if these muscles don't work, they cannot stabilize that envelope. The envelope becomes relatively sloppy. And because neurologically, the deep abdominal wall, all these muscles are neurologically tied together. So generally, if the multifidus muscles are not working, the pelvic floor, the transverse abdominis, and the diaphragm are also dysfunctional together. You understand that? So generally, in most cases, it's almost impossible to have one part of the system work and another part not work. You with me on that? Females do have the ability, more so than men, to create a problem where they overuse their pelvic floor and underuse their abdominal, but it usually happens from childbearing and or surgical procedures such as hysterectomies and cesarean sections. I talk about that in some of my other lectures. I don't have time to go into it today, but I'll tell you that there are a class of women out there that do that, okay? So now when we go to pick up a weight, if everything's working correctly, I teach people the first thing you saw, how I had Mark take a deep breath, right? Well, taking a deep breath fills the thoracic cavity. The football represents the abdominal cavity. If the thoracic cavity is not charged, then you've got a rigid cavity against a soft cavity, and the body just collapses. Okay, so you have to use proper breathing in weightlifting to charge the two cavities to stabilize each other. When you do it right, you charge the lungs, which stabilizes this cavity, and then as the belly button draws in, it pushes the internal organs up into the diaphragm, down into the pelvic basin, and because the diaphragm is also contracting, it causes a lifting force on the spine. Who can tell me where the tendons or the cura of the diaphragm attach? What level of the spine? Anyone know? L2 and L3. So when the belly button moves in and the organs rise up to the diaphragm and the diaphragm contracts against them, you know, the diaphragm has costal innervation and phrenic innervation. So it's innervated by all the intercostal nerves and by the C3-4 segment of your neck. So when the diaphragm contracts, it basically presses down. But because the diaphragm's tendons attach to the anterior vertebral bodies of L2 and L3, the contraction of the diaphragm actually causes a decompression of L4 and L5. Can you understand how that works? Okay. Because as the diaphragm contracts against the viscera that are rising up because the hoop tension created by the transverse abdominis, the tendons lift up and that decompresses the L4, 5 and L5 S1 discs. Now, there's variances of opinion on how much decompression that creates. Grakovetsky says it's only about 6%. But if you read the book Athletic Ability by Rolf Weirhead, he says it can be up to 40%. The literature varies. One thing I know as a clinician is, A, I don't care how much it is. I just know that if the system's not working, you're in trouble. Okay? And I know that if one part of the system's not working, the other parts aren't working either. So as a clinician, in order to get my patients and my athletes to perform well, I got to make sure the entire system is running effectively. Now, inter-unit recruitment always starts from the core, the transverse abdominis. Okay, remember all the muscles, transverse abdominis, multifidus, pelvic floor, and diaphragm. That is represented by the star. That's the origin of the recruitment because our arms and legs theoretically came afterwards in human development, if you subscribe to the evolutionary theory. If you want to read more about this, there's two books I would like to recommend to you. One of them's out of print and hard to get, but you could probably find it in the library. It's called The Spinal Engine by Grakovetsky. And if you just spell it like it sounds, you'll be close enough. Okay, Grakovetsky. And the other one is called Movement, Stability, and Low Back Pain, which might be in your reference list. Is there one in there called?
I don't see it.
Spinal Engine in there? Okay. Movement, Stability, and Low Back Pain by Vleeming, V-L-E-E-M-I-N-G, Mooney, M-O-O-N-E-Y, and there's one other author. I can't remember his name, but you'll find it by the book titled Movement, Stability, and Low Back Pain. So anyhow, and research from the Australians, you can read the book Therapeutic Exercise for Spinal Segmental Stabilization by Richardson, Joel, Hodges, and Hides, which is probably in your references there. They all show you that neurologically, it's been very well documented that before you move an arm or a leg, this inner unit system has to fire because the core is actually the stabilizer system for the shoulders and arms, and it's the stabilizer system for the pelvis, which is the stabilizer system for the hip, knee, ankle, and foot. So in order for you to effectively apply force, the stabilization wave emanates from the inside to the outside. It goes core, pelvis, arm, shoulder, leg, pelvis, shoulder, leg, arm, and hand, etc. So the analogy I give my patients is if you drop a pebble in a bathtub, there will be a ripple, and it'll go out until it hits the edge of the bathtub, won't it? Okay? Well, keep that in mind. Now I'm going to show you what happens when the pebble hits the edge of the bathtub. Now the outer unit systems can effectively work because they have a working foundation to generate force from. Now these systems were popularized by André Vleeming and his professor Snijders from Rotterdam, and they're described in the book Movement, Stability, and Low Back Pain. You can also read the book The Pelvic Girdle by Diane Lee, a Canadian physiotherapist. But to be honest with you, these things have been known about for a long time. I've got articles written in 1947 by Raymond A. Dart from the University of Witwatersrand in South Africa. And his articles are called The Double Spiral Mechanism of the Human Body. And basically, Dart showed how this worked in 47. And I also have old articles from 1913 in orthopedic textbooks and anatomy drawings showing exactly these types of things by a German anatomist. But Vleeming was the first person to show technically and scientifically that it really worked. Okay. So what you have here is you can see the thoracolumbar fascia peeled back. You can see the latissimus dorsi communicating with that thoracolumbar fascia. And if you look at this blue arrow, you can see that the line of the muscle action through the fascia merges perfectly with the action of the gluteus maximus. What Vleeming's research showed and what Raymond Dart said and other people said years ago but could never prove it was that the latissimus dorsi and the gluteus maximus work synergistically together. And when you're walking, they act like a giant force couple mechanism to pull on the thoracolumbar fascia, and that connective tissue acts like a giant rubber band storing energy, okay? You can actually feel quite easily how much energy is stored in the system if you just compare what it feels like to run on land, on hard land like a road or on a dirt road compared to how much energy it takes to run in sand. Because in order for this thing to store energy, the kinetic wave has to come back up through the leg and it gets stored in that fascia system. So if your foot strikes the ground and all your kinetic energy dissipates into the sand, there's nothing left to store in the fascia. So your abdominal muscles have to work much harder to rotate the trunk because they've lost their energy storage system. What you're seeing here in gait is that if you look at how the body works, as the left leg comes forward, the right arm comes forward, doesn't it? So that stretches the gluteus maximus. This stretches the lat. That puts tension on the thoracolumbar fascia. And then right when you go to propel yourself, there's a contraction in the lat and the hip simultaneously, which further stretches it. And that causes, just like the release of a slingshot, you pull it back and let it go, right? Well, right when you come to here and start pushing yourself up in a field of gravity, the energy is released out of that fascia. And it helps lift you up. Now, this fascial system works in concert with all the ligaments of the spine, with all the discs. Each of your discs have half of it fiber. Half the fibers go that way, half go that way. So when one leg's forward, 50% of all the fibers of all your discs are wound, and they're storing energy like a spring. It also works in concert with the cartilage of the hip, the cartilage of the knee, the long tendons of the hamstrings, the aponeurosis of the soleus and the gastroc, the Achilles tendon, and the plantar fascia. All our energy storage systems, they're all beautifully timed and they all work together. That's part of the outer unit. That's called the posterior oblique system. Why is this important in a discussion on weight belts? Well, if you look right here, that glute and that lat cross right over the what? The SI joint. There's the SI joint right there. When that lat and that glute fire, it causes what is called force closure of the SI joint. So when you're doing a functional activity, think of if I was wrestling with someone and I went to grab them, I'd reach just like that, wouldn't I? Well, in order to stabilize that sacroiliac joint, this lat and this glute lock down, and that stabilizes the SI joint, which is the working foundation for the lumbar spine. And that lat and that glute are dependent on which set of muscles in order to have a working foundation. The inner unit. Because the inner unit stabilizes the pelvis and the spine at a segmental level. So it gives this a working, these are like giant engines, and they need that inner unit system to create the stiffness to give it something to work again. Otherwise, all that contraction would do is just torque the spine out. Can you understand that? Okay. Here you see the anterior oblique system. So you've got the external oblique, internal oblique, and adductors working together. So what happens is as you're walking right here, when you've got 1 foot forward like that, this adductor, this internal oblique, and this external oblique are going to, as I'm coming forward, as soon as that foot strikes the ground, they're going to pull me forward. This adductor closes the pelvis. It internally rotates the pelvis, okay, against the hip. This internal oblique helps pull the linea alba toward this leg. And this external oblique holding hands with this internal oblique helps propel me. So this system right here is the antagonist. Here you see external oblique, internal oblique adductor, and then right around the corner, there's the lat, and on the opposite side is the glute. Can you visualize the sling going around the body at an oblique angle? So when this system's shortening, what's happening to the posterior oblique system? It's lengthening. This is like a self-winding watch. This is the most incredible system you'll ever find. Whoever designed this is more than a genius. And the only people that could ever screw it up are us. Okay? So what you see is this thing shortens, and when it spends energy, it saves energy in the other system. When the other one spends energy, it saves energy in this system. It's amazing. But now think of all the things that people do in the gyms and all the machines where you can't use the system because you're using the body against the natural design of the body. Can you use that on a leg press? Can you use it on a knee extension machine, hamstring curl machine, calf raise? You can't use that on any machine because it goes against the design of the body. So what you train the body to do is to do something it can't do in nature. And this is why you got people that look good but have poor motor skills and they're hurt all the time. They have what I call stupid muscles. Okay? You build a bunch of muscle, but it's unintelligent. So here you see the lateral system, the quadratus lumborum, internal oblique, external oblique, and opposite gluteus medius work in concert with the ipsilateral, that means same side adductors, to stabilize the pelvis and the frontal plane. When we used to be primal beings, we had to carry our food home and carry objects, firewood, all sorts of things home. When you stand on one leg, these muscles work to keep your pelvis from dropping out. If this system's not working properly, when you stand on one leg, your hip drops out like that. Can you see that? If that and that and that doesn't work, then you'll fall to the side like that. What's that?
Pull it in.
That muscle and that muscle and that muscle work against each other to keep the pelvis level so that this leg can swing through. Okay, there's another very important thing that has to happen. Your center of gravity has to stay over top of that foot, okay? If your hip drops out like that, your center of gravity moves lateral. Can you see that? If your center of gravity moves lateral to the subtalar joint, which gives you the ability to pronate and supinate your foot, what's going to happen? You're going to roll your ankle. And lo and behold, if you test any of your clients that's had multiple ankle sprains, more than one ankle sprain on the same ankle, almost always you'll find a gluteus medius adductor or quadratus lumborum dysfunction that has to be treated or they'll never get over the ankle injuries. Okay? Again, why I'm showing you these systems here with regard to belt use is because when you wear belts, you screw up the inner unit, and the inner unit is the prerequisite to function of the outer unit. And what research shows conclusively, if you go to my website and look at all the references, you'll see that research shows that when they tested belt users, they oftentimes compensated for the lack of inner unit function by overusing these muscles, and they found faulty recruitment patterns through the trunk and all through the legs.